And it is our privilege to be with you. Each time we're invited here, we love this. You know, we love to look in these faces that we recognize. And let me just remind you again of something that I remind you of most often when I'm here, but you need to hear it again. You are part of a great church. And you need to understand that and kind of live into it. You're part of a great church. God has gifted you with godly leaders who love you, pray for you, and feed you and lead you. And for what it's worth, I brag about you all the time. My students get tired of hearing about you. Just let you know. Yeah, fine, okay. But you need to hear that and be encouraged with that, that God has placed you here in the midst of a body of believers who honestly are following Jesus and making a difference for the kingdom where you are. I also want to thank you for this past week, the first week I was here, accommodating us, shifting everything around for us so that we could kind of get up early. I could get up early in the service, and then we could literally jet out of here afterward and catch a plane, go up to Washington, and make our way out to a memorial service out there. And it was a significant thing. It was our nephew that had passed away, and so there was a lot of family gathering from all over the country. And but those events like that, the memorial service, a funeral, are significant things for us to be at. As much as we hate them, they're important for us all to be at those things. Because in the midst of those, and I found myself doing it again, it's like you can't not do this. We find ourselves thinking through those ultimate questions again. You know, what's life all about? What things matter most in life? And kind of challenged in our thinking. Again, it's one of those things you can't get around. Challenged in our thinking as we kind of look at ourselves and say, am I living the life that I want to live? Am I living the life that I should be living? Am I living a life that if it ended today and I stepped into the presence of my Savior, in the presence of Jesus and looked into His eyes, I'd be able to say that that I had gifted my life to Him and to hear Him say, well done. And it forces that. It forces you to ask those kinds of questions and kind of come to grips with some reality of pieces. Now, with that, Psalm 37 that we're going through addresses all of that. It addresses those ultimate questions. It addresses all those peripheral questions around that. What is life about? What matters most? How do we orient ourselves in a world that often seems to make no sense? It's like it's upside down and crazy. Right? So, make your way to Psalm 37. If you've got a paper Bible, all your Bible junk should be located there now, because we'll be there. Otherwise, you've got your tab set for finding wherever it is, you know, in your tech device or whatever. Make your way to Psalm 37. Let me remind you a little bit again. If you were here last week, it's a reminder. If you weren't here, it kind of brings you up to speed on where we are. Psalm 37 is a psalm that has and continues to have great impact on me. It's kind of my current place to reside. And it does so for multiple reasons. One is it's a psalm of David, but not just any psalm of David. It's a psalm that is not written as a young man with a slingshot, with great ideas about what life should be. Rather, it's a psalm that is written at the end of David's life, perhaps the last psalm he ever wrote. It's a psalm that is written after all of David's great victories and failures, all of his the great things that have gone on and all the things that were devastating in his life. All of that. He's walked through life and he's collecting it all here and saying at the end of his life, here's what I've found. Here are the keys to life. Here is what I've discovered that matters most and makes life work. Now that's enough to say, cool, let's get into it, because it's him pulling together the insights of someone who loves God and has had both the successes and the failures of life. He's seen it all and says, here's how it works. Now, another piece let me add to this, you know, as far as and realize how significant it is. It's not just a psalm written at the end of David's life, but it's a psalm that is masterfully crafted. Now, we can't see that in our translation. My English translation kind of, you know, beats the snot out of this idea. But if we were reading it in Hebrew, this is beautifully crafted. It's what we would call an acrostic psalm. Every single line of the psalm begins with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And within it, there's all this beautiful poetry that takes place that we don't really see as we're going through here. So it's not only David pulling his pieces together at the end of life and saying, here's my insight for you, but he's doing it in a way that is masterfully crafted. Okay, now, Psalm 37. Looking at those first couple of verses again, because I mentioned last time that we would kind of revisit them each time and kind of build them out a little bit farther so we're not just dumping the truck on you to begin with. But in those first couple of verses, David is addressing something that was at the very center of Jewish thinking at the time that he lived and continued all the way down to the time that Jesus is living. It's a core piece of their philosophy. And the philosophy was, if I do what God says, if I take God's law and I live it out, my life will be wonderful. God blesses those who do what he says. Now, there's truth in that. Remember, we live in a broken, fallen world. But the idea was that if I do this, everything works out well for me. And for those who don't do that, life falls apart. In other words, God blesses the good. God curses those who are not good. And yet, as David walks through life, he says, you know, I've seen something here. Something that is this great mystery of what's going on. I've seen that as we live in this broken, fallen world, it's like someone has taken everything and turned it upside down. It's like there's, you know, the wrong people seem to win. And so often life is unfair. And sometimes it seems as though God has kind of just walked away. Like, where is God in the midst of all this thing? Is God really in control of things? And that was something that kind of buzzed in everybody's thinking. Here's how it's supposed to work. Here's how it seems to work. And David just owns it right up front. Says, look, here's the deal. And writes it out this way. He says, do not fret because of evildoers and do not be envious toward wrongdoers. Now just stop and look at those things. When he says that, he's calling attention to two things that are similar but different. Two ways that life kind of goes sideways and looks weird to us, says it. He calls attention to, for one thing, those he describes as the evildoers, and then another group, similar but different, the wrongdoers. Now, in calling attention to these people, we all can kind of probably put faces on some of this, or recent headlines on some of this. The evildoers. That terminology, as it runs through the Old Testament, has to do with those who intentionally desire to harm somebody. Those who desire to destroy others and cause pain, and those who desire to carelessly destroy what is good. The evildoers. And then there's this other group here, the wrongdoers. Now, it's kind of more a softer version of the first one. In other words, these are not people that are out to actually hurt someone or harm someone. But they're people, as you read through the Old Testament, this category of people, it describes people who are morally and ethically bankrupt. They have no moral compass. And they gain what they have by way of lies and deceit and kind of working around the systems and all that kind of stuff. And he gives reactions to these. He says, do not fret because of the evildoers. In other words, do not allow this to kind of form inside where it actually literally creates a flame inside you and you live a reactive life where you're always angry at a world that is not right. Living reactively. And with the other one, he says, do not envy those who are the wrongdoers, who somehow got what they have and they're living well and everything seems to be going good for them, and yet they got it all the wrong way. So do not be envious toward them. Here's the alternative, he says. Now I'll add verse 2 next week on this thing. But first of all, he puts these pieces out there and says, look, this is the way life looks. And it's true, there are these people. In fact, with the evildoers, perhaps you have a face that comes to mind. You go, yeah, I got those people in my life. People who seem to stay awake at night dreaming up how they can cause me pain. How they can destroy me. Okay? Or you may have people in your life that you look to and they're the wrongdoers. You know, the people who somehow everything seems to be working right for them, and yet they did it all in a way that is corrupt. David puts that out and says, look, that's a reality that we live in. Now, what he adds to it, we'll build more on this next time, but adds to it, he says, don't be deceived. There's a bigger story playing out. Don't be deceived. And instead, he gives us, in the following verses, four keys to life. In other words, four ways of orienting ourselves as those who have found redemption in our Redeemer God, in the person of Jesus. Four ways of orienting ourselves that address this whole idea of an upside-down world. And they come out in these terms. Trust in the Lord. Delight in the Lord. Commit your way to the Lord. And rest in the Lord. I believe those are in sequence there. They're not just randomly dropped in there. They all follow a pattern as he walks through. And all of them have some common features to them. And you notice in the Lord is part of it. Everything is going to be that he's giving us revolves around orienting ourselves around the God that we know, our Redeemer God. But they're also all choices that we make. Our default in life is to be those who, at least on my translation, fret and are envious. That's the default. But they're choices that we make. And not just advice choices. He puts them in terminology to where they're all imperatives. In other words, they're commands, they're priorities. He says, now this really matters. This is what should be driving our life. And they're all alternatives. So he lays these four things out there. And last week we looked at the first of these. First one, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. And it's the starting point. This idea of trusting in the Lord. Now, trust is the foundation of any relationship, regardless of what that is, whether it's friends or business partners or your marriage or whatever. Trust is the foundation of it. And he says here, trust in the Lord. Not, it's one thing to gather a lot of information about God and to actually believe the information is true. But trust is a relational term. It's what takes that information and puts it in terms of how I am going to relate to God. Trusting in the Lord has to do with the idea of a sense of well-being and security that comes from placing confident expectation in God. It's what settles me down in this world. When I choose to trust God, to trust in the Lord, to trust in my Redeemer God, it frees me from living a reactive life. It frees me to do what the second part of that line is. It says, trust in the Lord and do good. It frees me instead of being one who is just constantly angry at those who are doing evil in this world. It frees me, which we, by the way, we should. We should be ones who have what would be described as a righteous anger toward evil. But instead of simply living a reactive life where we are always angry people, he says, trust in the Lord and do good. In fact, later in verse 12, I believe it is, he talks about the idea of, it's down farther, where he says, trust, verse 27, depart from evil and do good. In other words, to have a complete separation from that, to live as people who have been set free from that. The counterpoint to it. trust in the Lord and do good. And then he says, you know, dwell in the lands, in other words, settle into life as it is and cultivate faithfulness. Settle into life as it is for you, which has all its uniqueness and ups and downs and whatever it is. Settle into that and have that be the setting where you cultivate faithfulness. Faithfulness, a good way to see that is faithfulness is trust that has been activated. It's the active version of trust. So in the midst of life, I'm cultivating, I'm learning what it's like to trust God in this set of circumstances. I'm learning what it's like to truly see God for who He is in the midst of what's going on here, and choosing to step into that, to trust Him. And in doing so, be set free to do good, to counterbalance what that is, to live a countercultural life. So that's your first part. Now we come to the next part here. The second key that he gives us, verse 4. He says, delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. I love coming to this verse here, because for many, this is kind of the verse you've been looking for, right? This is the one that says, ah, there it is, my golden key right here. Trust, delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give me the desires of my heart. I've been looking for that. Everything I want in this life I can get. All I have to do is figure out the first part. If I can get this one down, I get all this stuff here. Now, maybe you don't do that, but everybody around you, there are those who do that, who see this verse as kind of like their ticket to get what they want. So in stepping into this, let me kind of drop something in place here. Any of you have Catholic background? I mean, it's okay to say it. All I'm saying is you guys will get it. Okay. Others have to kind of come along with us about this. If you're in a Catholic background, one of the things you'd probably be familiar with is catechism. Okay. And a catechism is simply a teaching tool. It's a great idea. Catechism is simply a set of questions, and it gives you the answers. The part of a catechism is that it raises the questions that often we don't even ask. You know, we're asking kind of sideline questions or peripheral questions like that. And the catechism said, no, here's the questions you ought to be asking. And it kind of puts them out there. And then it gives us an answer for it. And a good catechism not only gives you a concise answer to it, but it also underwrites it with the scriptures so you can see how this all works together and things. It's a good idea. One of those catechisms that is one of the better known ones is the Westminster Catechism. Very first question in the Westminster Catechism is this. First question, what is the chief end of man? And that's one of those ultimate questions. Okay, it takes me back to kind of the last weekend type of thing. What is the chief end of man? Let me recraft that a bit so kind of we can step into it better. What it's asking is what is the primary purpose for our existence? Why was I created? What is my reason for existence and how should I orient myself in life? That's what it's asking here. What is my chief end? My main reason for living? And then it gives the answer to it. The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Take that apart just a little bit here. So the chief end of man is to glorify God. In other words, to put Him on display. To be a showcase for who He is. His great redemptive work and His transforming work inside our lives. All that is true about Him that comes out in what He does in us. To glorify God. To call attention to Him. To throw the floodlights on who He is. To glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Now, we get the first part perhaps more easily. You know, that, okay, I'm supposed to live a life that I'm going to somehow do this thing and put Him on display. I want people to see Him in me. Yes, which is great. It's the second part that gets a little squirrely for us. And enjoy Him forever. enjoy Him forever. John Piper. Some of you may know John Piper. He wrote a book called Desiring God. And in that book, what he does is he takes this first piece of the Westminster Confession and he alters it a little bit. He says, what is the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God by enjoying Him forever. Now that amplifies it, doesn't it? Kind of steps it up a little bit here. That one of the ways, well, perhaps one of the primary ways that we put Him on display is by enjoying Him. Not somehow doing a bunch of stuff for Him. Not just being obedient, which you should, but enjoying Him. As you look into this verse here, there are two words that sound fairly similar here. It says, delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. Delight and desire. They sound similar, but they're very different words. Desire has to do with what we don't have. We desire something. Whatever it is, it's some kind of, whatever you're currently desiring, that it's something you don't have. It's just out of your reach, whether it's a relationship or an object or a position or something like that. But it's I desire this. Okay? It's something that I don't have. And I have a longing or a yearning for it. Delight, on the other hand, has to do with what we do have. It has to do with enjoying and taking great pleasure in what is already there. Now, put that into this. He says, delight yourself in the Lord. There's inherent in the statement something that is already there that we are to take great pleasure in. The term delight, we kind of spend some time kind of working with this whole thing. It's delight as opposed to, say, obligatory obedience, or opposed to something like intellectual interest, which I am a seminary prof. I've got a lot of students who have a whole lot of intellectual interest in God. And should. We're glad they're there. But delight is something that carries it beyond that. There's an emotion tied to this whole thing. There are a lot of biblical terms that are like it, that are kind of synonyms to it. You walk through the scriptures and it talks about things like rejoicing in the Lord. Very similar idea to it. It has the idea of finding your joy in Him, of extolling the Lord, finding great value in Him, praising the Lord, celebrating Him, glorifying the Lord, we already talked about that, calling attention to Him. Bless the Lord, which has to do with treasuring Him. And at the very core of Jewish thought, you get to Deuteronomy 6, 4, and 5 there. And it says that calls us to love the Lord your God with everything that we have. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your mind and soul and everything you got, your muchness, it says. Same idea. The word delight here is a word that carries a lot with it, but it's an emotional word. You cannot delight with just thinking about it. It's a word that somehow captures all of you, forces something to happen. It's a word that carries the idea, for one thing, of luxuriating in something. You've been to a spa. Okay. You've been to a spa where you kind of just being out on the beach. That's the word. Luxuriate. It's the idea of savoring something. How many of you are foodies? Okay, this is another time. You can go ahead and somebody go. I know a bunch of people are. Been around you enough, I know you are. Ruthie and I, we love this thing. Some place that has great food. I'm not talking about McDonald's. I'm not talking about, I'm talking about, you know, those places where you go in and they've spent this vast amount of time putting flavors together, and every bite you kind of, you taste it. Oh, that is so good. Huh? Yeah. Back here, whatever it was, a month of these friends who are ultimate foodies. And you think you're a foodie, these are ultimate foodies. If you're familiar with the French Laundry, which is actually a restaurant, if you're not kidding. French Laundry, it's like one of the best restaurants in the world. And it's not that terribly far away from us. These friends of ours have been to the French Laundry like four times. In a lifetime, if you go once, it's like you're in, okay? They've been four times, enough to where the last time that they went, he called in and they go, "Oh, Mr. Welty." And they had his name in the system there. "What can we do for you?" So these are our friends. As a Christmas gift, they gifted us a French Laundry dinner that they would make. So I realized, okay, that's, you're going, oh, okay, no, no, but you got to realize they know how to do it. They actually got the recipes. The last time they were there, they stole some stuff from the French Laundry so they could bring it back. No, they didn't really do that. I mean, they brought back the menus and they brought back, you know, some other stuff there so that they could do this thing. They gave it as a gift to us. They said, "Let us know when you want to do this thing. We're going to have you over and we will do it exactly like the French Laundry does." So it took us all the way until like, you know, a month or two back for us to actually do it. Okay, we kept stalling. Okay. So we show up over there and everything is immaculate. And they have spent all day doing all the detailed preparation of each little piece of it using their recipes, putting it all together and not only masterfully creating it, but then how it's even presented and all this kind of stuff. And it was this thing the whole evening, because it kind of goes on and on, you know. Every time you take a taste of something, it's like, oh, this is so good. That's in the Word. Okay? That's it. It's luxuriating. It's savoring. It's part of this idea. It's a word that carries the idea of recognizing and enjoying something that's exquisitely wonderful. It's that idea. In fact, if you follow this word down, okay, this is not all words do this, but this is a Hebrew term that continued all the way down to present day. If you went to Israel today, this word is active in modern Hebrew. Okay? You know what the word is? It's the word for party. Yeah. Now you have to think Jewish when you think party. Okay? This kind of thing. It's all the stops pulled out and music and dancing and all this kind of stuff. That's in the word. It's captured with that. Delight yourself in the Lord. Carries this idea of savoring and luxuriating, and remember David dancing in the streets. It's all that. I was talking about this in one of the courses I have, and usually this conversation gets everybody kind of hyped. And yet there was this one student, just saying, he's a guy, he's a macho kind of guy, and he's sitting like about four rows back. And I could see he's not hyped. And so I say, "Hey, you know, so what do you think?" And fascinating comment. He says, I not only agree with everything you say, I not only buy into this whole thing. In fact, everything inside me longs for that. But my whole life I've been steeped in a culture, in a family that fights the opposite of that. And says, I'm struggling to figure out how I would actually do that. Isn't that something? Now maybe you identify. Maybe you go, "I know what he's talking about." had a couple of responses. I said, hey, look, I'm Swedish. Okay. You got nothing on me. Plus, I said, you know, keep in mind who wrote this. This is a warrior that wrote it. This is a warrior king who comes to the end of his life, and what he's discovered is delight in him is one of the keys to life. Begins with trust, and it moves to delight. Trust frees us from living a reactive life. Delight frees us to live into the deepest longings of our heart. It allows us to somehow disengage from that longing or that envy of what others have and realize, I got it. I have it here. Delight yourself in the Lord, he says. And not just kind of throw yourself, delight yourself in the Lord as opposed to other things. Delight yourself in the Lord as in allowing him to become your ultimate fulfillment, what brings you the greatest joy, rather than something else. Now, let me drop something in here. My own study of this, I went looking in the scriptures. I tried to find, is there some place that actually can kind of put some pieces together and say, if I do this, 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 then I will delight in the Lord. Wouldn't that be good? I mean, to say, okay, how do I get there? Particularly for those of us, you know, maybe you're saying, well, I don't have that. How do I get there? And so I was kind of looking for, is there any place in Scripture that can kind of give me some kind of idea, a pathway from wherever this is to a place where I delight in the Lord? Wouldn't that be good? I found them. Two of them. There's a sequence of thought. One of them is found in Job 22. It's verses 21 to 26. You don't need to go there. Just jot it down. Believe me for what I say. But in Job, it's Eliphaz who is speaking. And Job's friends have all sorts of input they give, some good, some not so good, all that kind of stuff. But this is one of those good places where Eliphaz says, look, here's how it works. Begin, he says, by developing what you might say is trust in the Lord. Okay, that's the starting point, huh? I'm with him. And then he says, the next sequence of thoughts he gives is take away those things that distract you from your heart's desire. Those things that you put in place of delighting in the Lord. Other things that you find yourself delighting in because they give you some kind of temporary sense of security in life. So remove those things. And then he says this kind of cool statement. He says, then God will be your gold and you will delight in him. Cool sequence. Okay, you can do your own study on that and kind of follow it up on things. The other place is found in Isaiah 58. And this one, it's the last two verses of that chapter, 13 and 14. And in this one, the emphasis is on the Sabbath. Now, the Sabbath is one of those things that kind of gets squirrely in our thoughts often. God did not create the Sabbath, in other words, the seventh day. He did not create that as a way of taking a break because he was tired. It has nothing to do with that. In fact, he didn't even create it so that we would have a break, so we could have a day off, you know, work 6 days and have a day off. That's not the idea. Actually, the Sabbath is God's crowning day of creation. First 3 days, he forms the world. The second 3 days, he fills the world. And the seventh day is a day that is kind of the crowning day of creation, a day where it's intended to stop and say, look what has been completed. It's a day that, as it develops, it's a day that God calls upon his people to luxuriate in the wonder of what he has done, the finished work of a Redeemer God, to stop what you're doing and to look into the eyes of our God and realize that he is the ultimate of everything we long for. He is our great reward in life. And in these two verses, what the sequence goes, it says a couple of things. He says, first of all, it's this whole idea of trust that comes in. But then he says, to cease from pursuing your own pleasure. In other words, those things that somehow fill that space and kind of take away our appetite from God, that allow us to be temporarily okay. to cease from pursuing your own pleasure and cease from speaking your own words. In other words, stop trying to make up your own storyline and justify how we go about life. Instead, to settle into the wonder of what God has done. He says, and then you will delight in the Lord, and this cool phrase, and then you will ride on the high places of the earth. Pretty cool, isn't it? Let me give you a picture. While my father-in-law was still alive, he had this thing he would do whenever we had these larger family gatherings. And what it was he would bring out this big glass jar of coins. Now, granted, most of them were pennies and nickels and dimes, but there were some bigger ones in there. And for little kids, you know, that this is a big deal. It's kind of like a pot of gold. Just bring it out here, you know, set it out there. And he'd tell all the grandkids, each of you can come up and you can take as many as you can get in one handful. Now, you can imagine, you know, everybody's kind of going, you know, and they would push their hand down into this thing and try and get as much as they could on this and start to come and they drop out. So they dig farther down. They try to get more. Got it. And for them, that was like winning the lottery. No, probably totaled out to, you know, $1.95. But but still, wow, look what I got here. And God calls us to come to him and say, you can have as much as me as you want. I want you to dig deep into me and take out from this the wonder of who I am and what I have done. But you have to come with empty hands. You have to come with empty hands. If you come with your hands already filled with things, you get little to nothing, you know. It's when we're willing to let go of those things that we have chosen to somehow fill the empty spaces in us. When we let go of those things, that we free ourselves to take a hold of what God offers, which is Him in its fullest measure. So you come to the last part of this, the second line, which some of you just were waiting going, yeah, get to the second line. It says, and He will give you the desires of your heart. Now, we could play with this. We could say, yeah, really what it means is He'll give you what you really need. Again, that kind of, oh, okay. Or we could say what He'll do is He'll give you what you're supposed to have. Right? Doesn't say that, though, does it? He will give you the desires of your heart. Now, here's the thing. David is putting together for us something that adds up in this two lines of this one verse. Delight yourself in the Lord. In other words, have Him be what you desire, what you long for, you know, what you get your greatest pleasure in, right? That kind of luxuriate in Him. Savor Him. And what you're going to discover is that He is what you want. Because in this life, here's a reality. Every longing of the heart is ultimately a longing for Jesus. May not buy that, but it's true. Behind every longing that we have is a longing for Him. And so David, at the end of his life, is putting out something that is as true as it can possibly be. Delight yourself in the Lord. And He will give you the deepest longing of your heart. All the desires wrapped up into one place. The person of Jesus. Westminster Confession, Catechism. What is the chief end of man? In other words, what is your chief end, your main purpose in life, what God has designed you for? God has designed you and me to glorify God. Put him on display. To have everything in our life point to the wonders of who he is. And to enjoy him. Enjoy him. Forever. Or as John Piper would say, glorify God by enjoying him forever. Let's pray.